This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, For the Love of Emery's. And the authors are Barbara Ann and Pete Simone, and they join us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Barbara Ann. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Steve.
Good to have you with us. First, I would like to read what you've written concerning the book so we can understand the theme. Christina's dream of owning a pet comes to a tragic halt after years of joy when her four-legged best friend dies. Heartbroken and filled with grief, she wonders how she will ever be happy again. Thanks to Misty, the magical dragon, Christy learns something about herself that not only helps her move through her grief, but also empowers her for the rest of her life. Well, that's a great, great message, because so many, young and old, we have to deal with grief for pets, for loved ones. Why did you decide to do this, Barbara Ann?
Well, Steve, first of all, Misty is a dragonfly, and she represents something that's very powerful within all of us that I have discovered to help us move through grief. I had the experience many years ago of owning a dog for about 10 years, and when he passed on, I was devastated, and I just wasn't sure how I was going to move through it. And through a series of experiences, which really are in the book that we wrote, I discovered something within me that is so powerful and so magnificent, and when I got in touch with that, I was able to move through the grief from losing this dog, and then able to go on, and I got other dogs and other cats, and that's really what the book is about, is that that changeless power of love that's within all of us, that Christina discovers in the story, and what Misty reminds her about, is something so powerful that really can support us to move through grief so we don't feel stuck anymore.
Pete, tell us about your background and how that aided in the creation of this book.
Well, Steve, my background is as a chemical engineer, and in spite of my chemical engineering training, I've always had a fascination with reading about science, and I read a lot about what's called metaphysics, which is really about the nature of reality. And I've read books from around the world, different philosophers, different perspectives. And one of the things that seemed to be prevalent in most everything that I've read had to do with the power of thought and feeling. When you combine those two together, you can have magical experiences occur in your life. And maybe, Barbara Ann, you could comment about that as well.
Well, when in the book, when Christina really gets in touch with the power of love that's inside of her and realizes that that love is changeless, she's then able to go on and move through the whole experience of grief and open up her heart to love again, to love another pet again. Now, along with that book, we have a workbook that parents and teachers can work with the child with the book. And in that workbook, we specifically talk about how one way to get through grief is as you contact that tremendous power of love with inside of you, if then you have loving thoughts and feel love for yourself and for life, you are able to get yourself to move through grief. You have that power. And that whole idea comes out with the workbook that goes along for the love of Emery's. So not only are we tapping into that power of love that brings us forward and creates, we are understanding that, yes, we do love, but let's think loving thoughts. Let's feel love for life. And that is really where the magic comes from. And that is the magic of Misty, the magical dragonfly.
And also the magic of your website.
Thank you.
Well, Well, yes, Pete was the magician of the website, and all of that is, you know, it's uplifting. And you know what? That's an interesting idea, Steve, because when you look at the website, it is magical and it is uplifting, but yet it's about grief. And we all know that grief is anything but uplifting. You know, grief is that universal experience, yet personal, that we all feel when we lose someone. But what we wanted to do with Misty was to bring that idea of love, and love is uplifting, and love is magical. So no matter what you're going through with grief, that feeling of love, that is that magical feeling, can and does in the story bring Christina and bring all of us to another point.
As a matter of fact, Barbara, and you had mentioned in your book, in the very beginning, you say, and I quote, "Ultimately, the awareness of the power of love is the magic bridge that will help us all travel through life's experience of change, specifically when someone or something we cherish is gone." And that's really the point. It's that bridge that really carries us through, and it's getting through the grief that is what Misty is all about.
And you know, sometimes that is the hardest thing to feel when you're grieving. You don't feel love. You feel hurt, you feel anger, you feel upset and confused. You know, I work with children as a volunteer in this children bereavement program here in South Carolina, and you know, all the different, you know, negative emotions that children experience during grief, I mean, the hardest one is to come back and love again. But as we look at all these emotions and as we choose to get rid of them, and let that love that's underneath all those emotions be, that's where the healing is, and that's how we do move through it.
And the website is?
It's magicalplanet.com.
Magicalplanet.com. Now, Christina and Emery are the best buddies. They have so much fun together. You build that so beautifully at the beginning of a book, and the illustrations are incredible.
I agree with you, Steve. My illustrator, Sarah Picarino, we worked diligently for about a year, and she really captured the soul of what this whole story is about. She's absolutely magnificent, and it's true that the relationship between Christina and Emery's is a relationship that I think so many people, children and adults, really get. I mean, our pets are our family members, and they're so important to us. And, you know, we're just not used to having, you know, one die after 5 or 10 years. I actually had Emery's for 10 years when that happened to me. But those relationships are so precious, and when they end, it really is a tragedy.
And Misty, the magical dragonfly, shows up just at the right time, and she has a very big question to ask Christina.
Yes, Misty's tagline is, "What's dragging you down?" And that is the question to have the child or an adult open up to be able to have a conversation with Misty. Our intention is for Misty to be that character where children can, you know, feel safe and be able to talk with her and to explain to her what's going on. So Misty really is a child's best friend when it comes to what's happening.
And she has a beautiful song.
Yes, Misty talks in rhymes. Now, when we have another story, the background story of Misty, it's called Misty Comes to Earth and How She Grew Her Wings. And one of the things she talks about is that, yes, from her planet where she's from, they a lot of times talk in rhymes. So it's why rhyming is so important, because we really listen when words are rhyming. So I believe that as Misty was giving Christina this rhyme from her heart, that Christina really listened intently. And as she goes on in the story and meets the other dog, she really has that rhyme within her, and it really does help her transform her situation.
Yes, here's a verse. "I sense the pain and loss you feel now that Emery's is gone, but know that deep within your heart, the love you shared lives on." Very well put.
And the third stanza, "People, places, and things will change, yet love will always be. It lives in you and surrounds you too. Depend on it to lead." And that probably is the most important message, I guess, that Misty would say, is that everything in life is going to change. Christina's going to grow up. We all change. You know, the seasons change. Everything changes in life. So what can we depend on? In a world right now where everything seems to be changing so quickly, the one thing that we all can depend on is within us. It's that love within us. It's a very powerful force. And that really is the main message of this book, that Christina does absorb, that it, she can still love. It doesn't have to be Emery's. It can be another book. Another dog. It can be another cat or anything else. That's the changeless power of love, and that is the most powerful part of this story, and I think of our whole message.
And children love to dramatize stories.
Yes, they do. And when I use this book with the bereavement program here in South Carolina, I had brought in a pair of dragonfly wings, and, you know, they put the wings on, and a little girl was with a little boy saying, you know, what's dragging you down? And they loved that. They loved pretending to be Misty and being that magical dragonfly to help other children who are grieving. So it's a real friendly character that children, I believe, will really enjoy, acting out and learning more about her.
And I guess, Barbara, and you've noticed how, you know, this is quite a unique scenario, because when you try to talk to the children and all that, they really don't want to have anything that's preachy or anything like that. But when you start telling a story, you really captivate them and get their attention.
Right. This story opens up so many dialogues, and we have a free download on the website to help parents and teachers. But it opens up so many dialogues with the children about what happened to the loved one. I mean, in this story, you know, Emery's was cremated, and we've got the ashes, but it can open up dialogues about, you know, how the loved one, maybe there was a funeral. There's a part of the story where Christina finds out that Emery's has a disease, and, you know, she's not sure how long Emery's will live, but Christina's mom suggests she looks on the bright side and enjoy every single day that she has with Emery's before he passes. That's another really invaluable lesson. So there's a lot of things going on in this story that parents and teachers can really use to open up tremendous healing dialogues with children.
Well, there's not another book on the market like this for children.
Absolutely not. This is a very unique deal, and it really comes from the actual experience that Barbara Ann had with her dog, Emery's. And so I don't know, Barbara Ann, if you want to comment about how long it took you to put all this together. But
I had this idea for the book for a couple years, but it finally came together when I started working with the children's bereavement team here in South Carolina to understand how great it is to have a story for children to open up things that they may not want to talk about. And then to have somebody as lovable and likable as Misty, because, you know, you have grief and you're feeling awful, but you don't want to feel awful. You want to feel happy again. And Misty really brings that out in children to say, yes, you can feel great again. You can feel good. You're never going to forget. You know, we never forget our loved ones. And in the story, Christina realizes she'll never forget about Emery's, but her heart is so filled with love, she can choose to love again. And she can choose eventually to think those loving thoughts and feel those loving feelings and move on.
And because we thought this message was so critical, Barbara Ann has written the other book called Misty Comes to Earth, which is available to be downloaded from the website. And that really was targeting more tweens and teens. It's a little bit of a different type of story, but it's very deep, and it has some other downloads that go with it as well, so that children of all ages can benefit from Misty's message. And I think, Barbara Ann, didn't we say that basically anybody who ever lost a pet would benefit from reading the book?
Well, definitely. First of all, for the love of Emery's, we are definitely finding out that it's a great gift to give anyone, an adult, that lost a pet. Because what do we say when we know, you know, someone lost their, you know, their cat, their dog? When we met someone who lost their guinea pigs, they were devastated. What do we say? Well, here's a wonderful present for them, you know, just to say, hey, look at this. Here's something that might, you know, help you understand that, yes, people do understand what you're going through, and this is an uplifting message that you can really, you know, use during that grieving time.
And it's really ironic. We put this on the website, but it's ironic that something so personal can be so universal. And it seems like people feel like they're so alone when they're going through grief. Yet we all go through it. You would think it'd be something that we would share and talk about and all that, but everybody feels isolated because it feels like such a personal experience that you're going through. And the more that people can talk about it and the more that it gets out there and discussed, the easier it is to be able to move through.
So it can,
I agree. That's exactly right.
So it can be used by people of all different religious denominations.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, because I have found, and I've worked with children with all different religious denominations, and they all have, you know, they're very beautiful ideas of what happens to dogs, cats, and people when they move on after death. Yet, even though we're secure about that knowledge, the part of missing the person, the part of missing the animal, that's the hard part. We know they're fine, but when the dog or cat is not there in the home anymore, or the aunt or uncle or, you know, a sibling, after someone has moved on, that's the hardest part. So, yes, grief is universal. It transcends all religious and all religious, you know, traditions and cultural traditions. It's that feeling of that loss. And that's really what Misty wants to bring forth, a healing idea of how to move through that.
The title of the book, For the Love of Emerys, the authors Barbara Ann and Pete Simone. Tell us how to get your book.
The greatest way to get the book is to go to our website, magicalplanet.com. And just click on For the Love of Emerys. You can buy it from Balboa Press and some other places. Also, there's a workbook that goes with For the Love of Emerys that I highly would suggest for anyone, any parent or counselor, or even just for a friend that you want to work with, to go through the whole book and to really understand how to move through the process. Also, there's Misty Comes to Earth, which is the whole background story of Misty, available on the website, and that's for teens and tweens. And there's some other free downloads also,
including Misty's Magical Message for Children.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you for being with us on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready for the Not-So-Soccer Mom Tuesday afternoons at 1 Eastern, noon Central on TogiNet with Jill Hickey. You name it, from politics to pop culture to Jill's search for the perfect bronzer and chicken salad. The Not-So-Soccer Mom will weigh in on it all. The sentence, "I have no opinion about that," is one that Jill has never uttered. In the early 90s, Jill finally decided to put her thoughts, opinions, mom advice, love of pop culture, hummus, and Starbucks, working out, cosmetic shopping, and politics into an actual website, and thus NotSoSoccerMom.com was born. Shortly after her fourth child, a boy, Jerome, now she's really got tons of topics to share with you. This is Laugh Out Loud Funny, and we're not kidding. What's a loud Nebraska girl who lived in Little Rock for many years and now is up in the Northeast doing? Chronicling her opinions on everything. The wheels aren't off yet, but it's close. It's the Not-So-Soccer Mom with Jill Hickey, Tuesday afternoons at 1 Eastern, noon Central, on TogiNet.com.
Holidays and celebrations get you down and leave you feeling frazzled? Then join Sandy Fowler and her guests on Heart-Filled Holidays every Monday at noon, 11 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com. Sandy will help you discover the secrets to having the celebrations you've always dreamed of while adding fun and meaning to your life. From Valentine's Day to Christmas to special family events, Sandy Fowler will show you how to put the fun and meaning back into those special days by taking a look at what we can do to turn the upcoming holidays into cherished memories and show us how to allow it to intertwine with everyday life. For more on the show, Sandy, and to receive Sandy's Holiday Happiness Booklet, go to HeartFilledHolidays.com. Then get set to discover the secrets to creating happy holidays and happy everydays by joining Sandy Fowler and her guests on Heartfilled Holidays every Monday at noon Eastern Standard Time on TogiNet.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Touched with Instructions, and the author, Iyana Ada McMillan. And Iyana joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this special interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Iyana.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you with us. Now, I'm going to read a few things you've written about Touched with Instructions. You say this: Touched with Instructions deals with understanding that the Lord touches us to get our attention because he has instructions for us. He knows all the challenges and responsibilities of our lives, and he wants to give us the information we need to experience the victory he has for us. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Iyana, and a little bit about your background and what the motivation was to publish this book.
Well, I'm an evangelist in good old York, Pennsylvania, and I'm also a newspaper reporter. However, I really take what the Lord is giving me to do and giving me to say and giving me to write very seriously. And so I noticed throughout my own personal relationship with the Lord that I would always have these experiences with him where I did feel his touch or had wonderful revival experience with him or felt his peace during private devotional times. But then once I came out of it, not fully understanding what that was about, why was he trying to get my attention, and what information was there after those experiences. And so it was based on that that the Lord really began to show me, even in his word, that his word isn't something that is just set aside in exchange for a spiritual experience, but that the spiritual experience we have with him and the word, it goes hand in hand. And so that's what I'm trying to convey to the readers.
In one of your chapters, you talk about what God will do in a second. And so you title that chapter, "The Blessing of Being Second." What makes being second a blessing?
Well, a lot of times, especially in today's society, the main thing is to be number one. Who's the national champion for a sports event, or who is the CEO or president of a company, even in church with church councils or church consistories, who's the president? And so in some ways we've been trained that in order to be effective, you have to be the number one. But what the Lord has shown us, especially with the life of Joseph and others, that is really his placement, wherever he places us in the situation. And so we may have asked God, "Lord, let me be number one," or "let me be the head of an organization or a group." And God is saying, "No, you need to be in the position I want you in." And whatever position he puts us in, that's where the blessing is. Joseph, when he was in Egypt, he was in the number two spot behind Pharaoh, but he had all of these blessings. He even had say over how famine and fullness were handled. He had a lot of influence and a lot of power because he was in the place that God put him. And so a lot of times the blessing isn't in that I got the head title. The blessing is that I'm where God has put me. And if he puts me in second so I can be a help to someone, if he makes me the vice chairman, if he makes me the number two person, it's because there's something that God wants me to do. And the blessing is being obedient in the place that he puts me and to be able to do those things he's calling me to do.
So as you say, the book goes beyond retelling experiences or encounters with the Lord. Through this book, people can learn why the Lord touches them and the responsibilities that come with his touches. And, of course, that puts a whole new meaning on these experiences.
Yes. The book starts out with the experience of the Apostle Peter, who was in prison. And there was a sentence over him that he would be executed. And so he is resting, and an angel came and touched him and woke him up. And as it is explained in the book, a lot of times we think that is the main thing. Oh, the Lord touched me. I saw the light. Everything just seems so wonderful. And God did not have time for that with Peter. you have a sentence over your head, I still yet have more for you to do. It's time for us to get moving. It's time to find out the direction I'm going to have you in. I just didn't touch you to make you feel good or to give you a great, wonderful experience or to even help you breathe better and feel this everlasting peace. I touched you because we have somewhere to go, and there are some things that must be done, and I have to get you from this place to the place I've had for you in your life.
People can learn about character building, home behaviors, overcoming failures and weariness, and restarting projects or ministries.
Yes. One of the main things that the Lord has taught me, even in my life, is that, especially when it comes to home behavior, I'll pick that particular issue, that sometimes we can even become strangers to our families in that what our families or who our families see in church or out in the community may not be the same person they see at home. And so the Lord wanting us to take those experiences that we had in church with him and to be able to manifest those experiences in the home and how we talk with each other and how we're supposed to help each other and how we're to be a blessing to and to lift each other up. Our home should be a safe place, as in people should be safe from our character issues, okay, and not wonder if we're going to go off or if we're going to speak improperly or make decisions that will hinder the progress of the household. And so the Lord would really have us to really learn what it is he wants to do in the family and what it is he wants to do even through us personally in our families so that we can be a blessing to the family. And so a lot of times what is needed is that we need to be touched with the instructions so that we can be the blessing that our family needs.
In another chapter, which is titled Boot Camp for the Ears, explain this boot camp.
Well, do you mind if I read?
Please.
This portion is one of my favorites, and when I do read it to people, people seem to enjoy it as well. So I'd like to read from that.
Go right ahead.
Okay, and it's a subject, Boot Camp for the Ears. When the Lord wakens us to hear as the learned, he is developing our ears to be disciplined and skillful in listening. This means we will have to go to listening boot camp. Some of our boot camp experiences may include getting up 3 a.m. for phone calls from people weighed down with troubles. They just need someone to listen. As listeners in training, God will not allow us to remind them of the time, hang up, sound groggy, or attempt to schedule a more convenient time to talk. We are in listening boot camp, and God wants us up, energized, and listening now. We must remember we are God's vessels. He uses us to accomplish his will in the earth and in people's lives. Therefore, if God desires to listen to that person at 3 a.m. and chooses to listen through us, then he'll waken our ears to hear. We will have to handle the assignment with maturity and obedience. In other boot camp training, we may find ourselves in a series of conversations where others are doing all the talking. We can't get a word in edgewise. In these situations, some of us will get angry, impatient, or hurt. We complain that they talked me to death. That is exactly what God wants to happen. Some of us are incessant talkers. So God is allowing people to talk us to death. Dead people don't talk. Some of us have a non-stop talking spirit that has to die. Then God will have room to make us patient listeners. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. That's James chapter 1, verse 19. As we continue our listening boot camp, the Lord may direct us to go to different locations where people need anointed listeners. For example, God may impress upon us to go to a certain store. We might think we are there for a good sale, but in aisle 3 is a man who needs someone to listen. We are listening, we are trying to shop, and he wants to talk and talk and talk. Turns out, the Lord led us to the store for listening boot camp. So that's a taste of that section, Boot Camp for the Ears.
Very well said, and all I can say to everything you just read is amen. Very well said. Very good, Iyana. Now let's talk about accepting rejection, and you call that victory. Rejection is victory, accepting it?
Well, the thing about rejection is that, and this stems from when Jesus was with his disciples, and Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem, and he wanted to go through Samaria, and the people would not allow him to go through the town, and so two of his disciples, James and John, wanted to call down fire from heaven and burn the town down. But Jesus was explaining to them that they were not of the right spirit. And so as far as accepting rejection, it's not a defeat. Really, it is an obedience, because Jesus let us know that we would be persecuted and that we would suffer rejections, but to not be afraid, that we are in good company, because there were those who were before us, prophets and teachers and apostles, who were rejected as well. Now, the blessing or the issue about accepting rejection is a protection for us. So even though rejection, it hurts, accepting it and accepting what God is saying about the rejection will protect us from doing things in response that could even get us into trouble, or that we could even hurt others because we're hurt from the rejection. And so the Lord would have us to understand not only how to deal with rejection, but also how to get around it. Because when Jesus was rejected from going through Samaria, he simply went another way. And so a lot of times the Lord may allow the rejection to stay in place because there's another way he wants to take us. And so we can even grow greater in the Lord, and even learn more about the Lord, and even learn more about how to negotiate through difficult situations if we will, in those times of rejection, not fight and try to barrel through and try to, you know, throw people down or push to the side and let me in anyway, but to go back to the Lord and say, Lord, how do I get through this? And in learning from the Lord how to get through it, now I have another revelation from the kingdom of God as to how to handle a difficult situation.
Now, you also talk about right. Right. That's hard to say many times in a row, but it's also very challenging for people to write these letters and to, I guess what you're talking about is to give people support through these people letters?
Yes. I'm a newspaper reporter, so I kind of have an inside understanding about the challenges and also the responsibility of writing right, or to even say it this way, to write things correctly. And the premise is that we have to make sure we are using God's words when we're corresponding one with another. There are, even in community activities, there are people who are really involved in their community. They go to their council meetings or borough and township meetings and really want to get involved in, and you know, we have petitions and people who send emails for different things, that we as Christians, even though there is an issue that, you know, we may be allowed to or may be right in how we challenge that issue, we still have a responsibility, even in putting down the words, to do it correctly. God is a wonderful writer. And so we really need to let him show us what it is we should write, how we should write it, the tone. Let him check our tone and make sure our tones are correct in the letters or the emails or even petitions. But God even holds us responsible for how we respond to issues, even in written form.
Another chapter is called Instructors Instructing Instructors. Another one is called Homework for the Tongue, and you have even written prayers that appear in various areas of the chapters.
Yes, as far as the prayers are concerned and why they are placed that way, the point of that is that once a section of a chapter is read, rather than just to keep going and then getting to the end and then just doing a prayer and moving on. It's more like a Selah moment. Just pause for a second. Just stop for a second. Think about what we're reading, praying those instructions into our lives, and really take time to meditate. This is not a book that is designed to be a quick read. It is a book that it could be a practical devotional, as I heard some people say, or a manual. It's really designed for us to really take time to stop, to consider, to understand things about ourselves, to understand principles in the Word, and to really allow the Lord to continue to speak in our spirits as we begin to see some insights even about ourselves. There have been some things in this book that as the Lord gave me to write, I was even surprised because it became instruction and it was even correction for me. So there were times when I even had to stop writing. And after the prayer was written, I had to go over that prayer and read that prayer and really let that prayer work in me before I could even begin writing anymore. And so hopefully it'll be the same way with other people while they're reading.
The title of the book, Touched with Instructions, and the author is Iyanna Ada McMillan. Iyanna, tell us how to get your book.
Okay, well, you can go to my website, and that's www.iyannamcmillan.com. You can also look online, for instance, Amazon.com, also WestboPress.com, and you can also go to your local bookstores and request the book.
Iyanna, thanks for being on Indie Book Publishing, this special interview brought to everyone by Westbow Press. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com.
The Coda Man Keith, and he's number one.
Now you might think Juan's youth was sad,
right?
Cause he had a deaf, ear, mommy, and dad,
right?
But that ain't the case.
Nope.
It wasn't his fate.
Nope.
The Juan's never struggled to communicate.
Ha.
Y'all wave your hands. Look who's on. Yeah. It's the Coda Man Keith. Number one.
It's That Keith Juan Show on TogiNet.com, Wednesday nights at 8, 7 Central. Every week, That Keith Juan Show will have guests that share their experiences, expertise, opinions, and personal lives with us to hopefully help us better understand others. The topics and guests will come from the American Sign Language community. For more on Keith Juan and the show, go to his website, KeithJuan.com. Listen with an open mind and willingness to learn and help with the cultural bridge.
Number one. Keith's number one. Everybody clap because the Coda Man's on. Number one. Keith's number one. Everybody clap because the Coda Man's on.
Don't miss That Keith Juan Show. Wednesday nights at 8, 7 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Galactic Tempest, and the author is Joseph Schwab. And Joseph joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this special interview brought to you by Trafford Publishing. Hello, Joseph.
Hello.
Well, good to have you with us. This is an epic struggle between two futuristic imperial societies. I just love it. From a geopolitical perspective. You've got a great imagination at a young age. Of course, this is a science fiction novel. It conveys a struggle between these two futuristic societies, and the conflict is shown through the eyes of the commanders of each faction. Very different. Most of the time, we usually see it through, you know, the regular soldier or the people of the in the society. But you're going right to the commanders, aren't you, to show how they're strategizing and all the different arsenals to gain domination over each other.
Yes. Well, the reason I chose to do it that way is because the generals have the perspective of the entire battle. And really, they're the only ones who can see how the grand strategies play out. Whereas with the frontline soldier, you've got a very narrow perspective of only what they're capable of seeing at any one time.
So tell us about these two futuristic societies. How far out in the future, first of all, how far out are we talking about?
Well, I didn't want to go too incredibly far out, but at the same time, the sort of resources and infrastructure that the needed to, like, build spaceships implies that it would have to be at least that far out. But one interesting note is, of course, they still use many technologies we'd use today. And the reason for that is not that they haven't advanced significantly. It's that in employing, you know, so many resources and troops and personnel in the field for different reasons, they find that it's more practical to use older technologies, whereas when they need to engage in, say, space conflict, that's when they use more advanced things.
Well, tell us, first of all, about the Reds.
Okay. Well, with them, I was trying to almost use the romanticized notions of past societies. So I tried to, you know, use a little bit like of how the Romans would be viewed, along with a little bit like how the Japanese have their code of honor, and with the Vikings being like real diehard warriors who, you know, want to fight to the end kind of thing. So basically I tried combining multiple different societies from classic and medieval perspectives into this sort of culture that might have happened in our time, but didn't end up coming to be. So they're focused on like hard work, honor, religious duty, that sort of thing. And you know, they're the sort of society that we could maybe identify with, but not anything that would really exist today.
But they are humanoid.
I made that just so that the reader would have something to identify with. I tried to keep humans and Earth out of the book on purpose, just so I'd have a clean slate to write everything from the beginning, basically. So I wouldn't have to worry about present-day considerations or our current timeline. I could just start everything completely from scratch.
And this humanoid Reds, as you put it, is strengthening their own civilization by terraforming and colonizing suitable planets. So they're trying to put together an empire?
Yes. Basically, the Reds are a solitary people. They don't like engaging with diplomacy with other races or engaging with trade. They're kind of xenophobic in a way because they know that other races don't share their interpretation of honor or their strict codes. So they try to focus only on, you know, using planets that no one's on and getting resources that no one's interested in, basically. And their society would be focused on, say, agriculture and industry, whereas their opposites, the Alliance, would be more focused on trade and technology, more like something you'd see today.
Now, are the Reds the good guys?
I try very hard to make sure that in any story I write, there is no good and there is no evil side. Basically, when people who have read my book talk to me, they like certain sides better than others, but everyone's given me a different interpretation of who they thought the good guys were and who they thought the bad guys were. So, you know, there are some things that are good about the Reds, but there are some things that aren't so good. For example, they tend not to show as much mercy. They tend to be a little more eager than they should to go into combat. And also, you know, there are numerous points where if they just weren't so prideful, the conflict wouldn't have happened in the first place. So you see, even though they seem like they might be more clear-cut good guy, they're not. And neither are the Alliance.
Now, the Alliance was started by this reptile group called the Elitus.
Yes, the idea is the Alliance is built on a coalition of planets and governments all sharing their different resources. So basically, they join together various planets that specialize in different things to form, you know, their early alliance. Later on, as they gain more power, population, wealth, they start adding in more and more planets to their alliance. Basically, they're almost like a federation or a collection of peoples, basically. And the only reason I use the Elitus in the beginning is because they're sort of the crafty, manipulative, calculating types that would come up with the idea to form a coalition to strengthen themselves and sort of catapult them to superpower status.
Well, and one thing that changes everything so these two futuristic societies can accomplish their great galactic goals is the discovery of this new travel system. What do you call it?
Well, they told me to come up with a shorter moniker, and the best I could come up with was STM, and that stands for Space-Time Manipulation, and then, of course, Travel.
So how do they somehow use a distortion in that kind of space-time relationship?
Well, basically, they use a powerful gravity generator, almost like you'd see it in the center of a singularity, like almost like a black hole or a wormhole. And basically, it allows them to form their own separate space-time bubble around their ship, allowing them to circumvent the passage of time and the distance of space. So basically, they're able to make a shortcut in space-time fabric, allowing them to go an incredibly large distance in a very, very short time with almost no, you know, time spent. So basically, it's almost like instantaneous travel between two very far away points.
Many light years in short bursts, as you put it.
Exactly, exactly. So basically, it's like one thing you see when you're talking about science fiction is they always say that you can't go faster than light speed under our current physics. But the way to circumvent that is you either have to somehow find a way to get around, you know, the space-time barrier, or you have to find a way to manipulate the object's mass in such a way that it would be able to go faster than light. But I chose the space-time manipulation because I think that if you look at Einstein's theories, he says that wormholes could exist, or maybe do exist, that allow you to bypass these barriers already. They're just in a form that we cannot yet exploit or understand because we're at such an early stage of spacefaring technology.
So how does conflict occur between the Red Empire and the Alliance? What triggers that?
Basically, they both go into an area that was neutral. They arrive about the same time, and neither one of them has claim to the sector. It's an important region because, as the way space-time jumps go, they have to go certain directions. This particular sector that they both run into is kind of an intersection between various space-time manipulation routes. So they end up running into each other almost like it was inevitable. But the thing is, since they both arrive at the same time and neither one of them has previous claim, they have to designate the area neutral and try to both have a presence there without actually owning the area. What ends up happening is the local inhabitants, who the cluster happens to have multiple habitable planets, as many would, don't necessarily take kindly to the notion of being colonial subjects or a third party or basically, they don't like being trampled on. So the third party eventually ends up organizing into sort of a guerrilla movement, an uprising. And what they end up doing is they end up rebelling against both the Alliance and the Red Empire. But the two superpowers are too busy fighting amongst themselves and having difficulty negotiating to take on this third side because they're both blocking each other diplomatically. What ends up happening is this third guerrilla uprising eventually attacks a facility important enough that it triggers a war because both of the factions are now at the point of, you know, they're fed up with each other, and this was sort of like the last straw. And once the guerrilla movement initiates their attack, it's sort of like the thing that sets everything off.
Tell us about the main characters.
Well, the main characters I focus on are two generals, both of whom are relatively new in the ranks of the military. They're both like lower ranks. And what ends up happening is both of them show a talent or proficiency for armed conflict. And at the beginning of the book, they both start out kind of as rank and file officers, but as the early battles allow them to kind of gain some notice and earn some respect, they keep rising through their respective ranks, both of which, you know, fighting in major battles, which determine the tide of the war. And as they both accumulate victories and start getting more and more important, eventually at the end, at the final battle, the two generals are now fighting each other, which in previous battles they were in separate places at separate times.
So are these battles graphic in nature?
Well, mostly what I tried to focus on is really each battle is over a particular planet, each one, of course, of lesser or greater importance. And usually how it goes is they have to both wage a battle in orbit over the planet and on the surface. And really, if either one goes a certain way, both will go a certain way. So they have to manage both this battle in space and on the ground in order to achieve victory. And I try to focus on them using different tactics and strategies to achieve this, while the generals, of course, you know, are carefully moving the pieces forward in trying to gain victory but not take on too many losses.
Of course, the aftermath of the war always results in consequences. In this case, you highlight the consequences on the primary characters.
Yeah, well, one of them kind of has an issue where they know it's their duty to be a commander, but they don't like losing troops under their command. And so one of the characters has a real difficulty whenever they incur losses or casualties. The other tends to have a naive view of conflict and war, thinking it's like a way to gain political power, but then realizes after a particularly disastrous battle that really, you know, war is not meant to be for politics and power, and that there are real consequences that must be acknowledged to in order to think on it logically. By the end of it, both of them have kind of gone over their character arc and really, for different reasons, they're both just trying to survive at the end.
Does this geopolitical struggle at all relate to what we're going through here on the planet Earth right now?
I'd only say that you'd see that for like a conflict zone. So like, say, if you're talking about the Middle East or Africa, or perhaps parts of South America, it's really when there's an area that is unstable, that has something that outside parties want, like resources, and multiple different countries get involved, that's what you'd call a geopolitical struggle. And whatever happens to that country will, of course, affect its neighbors in the region around it. So really, the closest thing I could compare it to is maybe the Libyan conflict, perhaps the first Gulf War, not really the second one. And really, the book is kind of set up into two segments. The first one, I explain the background of the societies, their various economies, technologies, structures. And in the second half, I'm more focusing on the conflict, its circumstances, and how the tide is going.
Joseph, tell us how to get your book, Galactic Tempest.
Well, it's available on Trafford, Borders, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and, of course, I sell it here locally in Central Oregon.
The author is Joseph Schwab and his book, Galactic Tempest. Thanks, Joseph, for being on Indie Book Publishing. And this segment is brought to everyone by Trafford Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.